My name is Jason Resch. Today I'm going to be talking about AONTRS, a new algorithm for storing data securely. The method was developed at CleverSafe in 2007, but more recently, James Plank and I evaluated its properties in comparison to other algorithms, both theoretically and experimentally. So this presentation is divided into four sections. In the first, I'll give a brief description of what dispersed storage is and outline some of its advantages. Next, I'll talk about some previous methods that have been used for securing dispersed data. Then I'll describe our new approach called AONTRS. And finally, I'll present some results we obtained from running several of these algorithms on production hardware. So if you haven't heard of dispersed storage, we define it as the computationally massaging data into related pieces and storing those pieces to separate locations. Resiliency is typically obtained through forward error correction, also known as erasure codes. And this provides a K of N fault tolerance. So of the N pieces produced, only K are required to reassemble your data. So here's an illustration to make the concept a little more concrete. In the first step, some input data, it could be a file, a blob, or a disk block, is processed by an information dispersal algorithm, or IDA, into N number of pieces. In this case, N is 16. Next, the slices are distributed to separate locations. They may be different disk drives, storage nodes, or geographic locations. Note that in every piece doesn't have to be written successfully in order to consider the overall write successful. So in this example, two nodes may have been down at this time, but because we've written 14, we may consider that a safe enough threshold that we can commit the data. At some future time, when the data is to be recreated, we only need to retrieve any threshold or K number of those pieces. So in this case, the threshold was 10. So we could tolerate up to 6 simultaneous failures and still get the data back. So there are a number of benefits to dispersing data. We just covered how it can lead to a system with a high degree of reliability and availability. And that's because K and N can be chosen arbitrarily to provide a configurable tolerance for drive, node, and site failure. It also, by distributing the data to separate locations, greatly reduces the risks of correlated failures. So in a system in which all the disks are within one machine or in one rack, that system is just one power spike or air conditioning failure or natural disaster away from being destroyed. Dispersal also allows data to be efficiently stored without the need for replication. So this is applications in disaster recovery. If you take the example we just looked at in a 10 of 16 configuration, if you distributed that data across 8 sites, so 2 slices at each site, you could tolerate 3 simultaneous site destructions without data loss. Yet the total storage requirements would be just 60% beyond the amount of data that's being stored. So it would be more efficient than storing a single backup copy. And as we'll see later, these algorithms can also lead to a high degree of security. So the conventional approach for achieving security for one's data is to encrypt it. However, there's little value in having an ultra-reliable data storage system, which is dependent on a less reliable key management system. So if you keep the key in just one location on one node, if that node gets destroyed, then you lose all the data that it's protecting. So to increase the reliability of the key, you may consider making multiple copies. Perhaps you store the key in multiple machines at different locations. But then this multiplies the numbers, the number of attack vectors. It makes it more likely you'll lose one of those keys, or one of those keys will fall into the hands of an attacker. So, but fortunately, in 1979, Addie Shamir and George Blakely independently discovered a solution to this problem called secret sharing. So in secret sharing, some message is divided into n pieces, and any threshold number of those pieces is sufficient to recover that message. However, anyone who has some number of those shares less than that minimum threshold doesn't learn anything about the content of the message. So this allows one to achieve simultaneously a high degree of privacy and reliability, because multiple breaches are required for an attacker to learn the content of the message, yet shares are still recoverable in the event that some of those are lost. So if you had a tape drive that was storing shares of some confidential information and you somehow lost it, it wouldn't be a cause for concern, because whoever possesses that tape backup doesn't have enough information to learn the message, and yet the data will still be recoverable so long as a threshold number of shares still exist. So one way to compare encryption with secret sharing is you can think of encryption as a special case of secret sharing, where both the number of shares and the threshold are equal to 2. So if you think of the ciphertext and the key as the 2 shares, you can see that both are required to get the original data, and if you lose either one, you won't be able to recover the data. So in that sense, secret sharing can provide a higher level of security than encryption, because the number of successful attacks can be set greater than 2 and arbitrarily high. There are, however, some drawbacks to secret sharing as it was originally proposed by Shamir and Blakely. The first limitation is that every share is the same size as the input in the case of Shamir. So if you wanted to create 5 shares for 1 terabyte of data, you would have to provision 5 terabytes of raw storage. For Blakely, it's even worse. If you had a, let's say, a 3 of 5 configuration, you need 15 terabytes of raw space. The encoding time is also problematic. For every byte that gets processed by Shamir, it requires n times k multiplications and additions. So to encode in a 3 of 5 configuration would be 10 times faster than a 10 of 15 configuration, for example. So this makes secret sharing unsuitable when you have bulk data storage, which is performance or cost sensitive. In 1989, Michael Rabin proposed information dispersal as a method to achieve efficiency, security, load balancing, and fault tolerance. The raw storage requirements using Rabin's IDA are n over k times the input size. So this allows for a high degree of efficiency, because n over k can be chosen such that they're close to 1. So, for example, in the 3 of 5 configuration we talked about, the total storage requirements would be 1.6 times the input size. And you can actually make a more efficient system without sacrificing reliability by increasing N and K. So if you use a 16 of 20 configuration, you would need 1.25 terabytes, and yet now you can tolerate 4 simultaneous failures instead of 2. However, the security provided by Rabin is not as strong as that of Shamir for a few reasons. One is that if an attacker possesses some number of shares less than the threshold, he can narrow down the possibilities for what the message is. So he does learn some information. And the other problem is that repetitions in input lead to repetitions in output. And that's because Rabin's idea is fully deterministic. So in that sense, encoding with the Rabin idea is similar to using a cipher in ECB mode. So we see here, if you imagine that the input to the Rabin idea was a bitmap file, every time the same set of pixels, the same threshold number of pixels appear in a row, it will lead to the same output in each of the shares that are produced. So you can see there are recognizable patterns of the input that appear in the output, where if the security were ideal, it would look like the final image in which there are no recognizable patterns. So Rubin suggested you could generate a different random matrix every time you encode k bytes. However, the problem then becomes, how do you store these matrices? Each of these encoding matrices, as we'll see, is an n by k matrix, and it only processes k elements of input. So each matrix is n times larger than the amount of data that it processes. So in the end, the efficiency would actually be worse than Shamir secret sharing. In 1993, Hugo Kravchuk combines elements of Shamir's secret sharing with the Rubin IDA. This method is known as secret sharing made short, and it essentially works as follows. The input is encrypted with a random encryption key. The encrypted results is then dispersed using Rabin's IDA, while the random key is then dispersed using Shamir's secret sharing. So this yields a computationally secure secret sharing scheme with good security and efficiency. I say it's computationally secure rather than information theoretically secure, because an attacker who possesses some of these shares or some of these slices can attempt to brute force the random encryption key. And that's another path that they can take to get the data versus obtaining a threshold number of slices. So now I'm going to talk about our technique, AONTRS. AONTRS stands for the All or Nothing Transform with Reed-Solomon encoding. It combines Ron Rivas' All or Nothing Transform with systematic Reed-Solomon encoding. The security and efficiency properties are similar to secret sharing made short, so it's a computationally secure secret sharing scheme. However, it has several advantages. The encoding is faster, the integrity is protected, the output is shorter, and rebuilding is simpler. So to understand AONTRS, you'll have to understand what the all or nothing transform is. It was first described in 1997 by Ron Rivas, and essentially it's a way of taking some input, transforming it into what appears to be random-looking information called an AONT package. And this package can be easily inverted to get back to the original input. However, if any of that transformation is missing, if any of the package is missing, then the reversing the process to learn anything about the input becomes computationally difficult. So to understand the performance advantages of our approach, we need to look at the encoding matrix, which is the basis of the Shamir, Rubin, and secret sharing made short methods. So in Shamir, the one element of input is going to be set as one of these k data elements, and the rest of the elements are chosen randomly. So to process that one element, which is typically one byte, you have to perform this matrix multiplication, which involves k times n multiplications and divisions, typically over a finite field. And the result is the n element. So that's why you get this n times expansion during the encoding. For Rubin and secret sharing made short, each of the k elements of data are bytes from the input. So you're processing k bytes at a time. So you're performing n multiplications and additions for every input byte. And again, the output is going to be n. In our case, we make an optimization. So both Shamir and Rubin depend on the matrix multiplication for security. If they were to use a matrix that looked like this, it would pretty much destroy the security properties of Rubin and Shamir. However, because we apply the R-nothing transform prior to this multiplication, and we use the all or nothing transform to provide security, we can make the matrix multiplication as efficient and as fast as possible. So to do that, we set the first k rows to be the identity matrix. And the math works out such that the first k bytes of input become the first k bytes output in the slices. So we only have to perform computation for the remaining k minus n slices you see on the bottom. So therefore, for every byte that we process, we're only performing n minus k multiplications and additions. So this diagram depicts a high-level overview of how AONT and the IDA fit together. When data first comes in, it's processed by the AONT to form this AONT package. The IDA then divides that package into k equally sized pieces. So let's say the threshold were 10 and we're processing a 1 megabyte AONT package. The IDA will produce 100K slices just by chopping up that 1 megabyte. The remaining slices from K plus 1 to N are then computed using that the matrix operation. So long as any threshold number of these slices are available, the IDA can perfectly recreate the AONT package. And then having that entire package, you can trivially get back the original data. However, if you're short of the threshold, let's say you have 9 of the slices, there's not enough information in those slices. You only have 900 kilobytes worth of slices, but you're trying to produce a 1 megabyte package. And therefore, without the entire package, you can't invert that to get the original data. So we made a few enhancements to the AONT beyond how it was originally proposed by Rivest. The first modification was we apply a single application of the hash function over the message. Rivest had suggested independently hashing every block of ciphertext separately and then XORing all the hashes together. But because the block size for hash functions is typically much larger, maybe 4 times larger than a typical block size of a cipher, you're causing the hash function to do 4 times as much work than is necessary. We also found that by appending a known value to the data prior to the encryption, we can validate during decoding that the integrity of all the slices that came in was correct. So the computation of the hash function doesn't go to waste. We leverage that to provide integrity. So now we're going to take a look at some of the internals of the algorithm as we implemented it, of the all or nothing transform. So data is, when it comes in, the first thing we do is append the canary value. That's that well-known value, which we call a canary because we check the health of it during decoding to ensure the health of the rest of the data. We then encrypt the data in the canary with a randomly generated key. The choice of the cipher is flexible. It could be typically any symmetric cipher. The encrypted result is then processed with a hash function. The hash function is also flexible. The only requirement is that its output length has to equal or exceed the length of the randomly generated key. And that's because we XOR the random key with the hash value to arrive at the bitwise difference between the two. The bitwise difference is then appended to the encrypted data, and the two together form the AONT package. So to get back the original data from the package, we recompute the hash value of the encrypted data, and then we XOR the bitwise difference with the hash value to yield the random key, which we then use to decrypt the data in the canary. So you can see readily, if any of the package were missing, you wouldn't be able to recompute the hash value, and therefore you wouldn't be able to recover the random key. And also, if any of the bits had been flipped in the package, you'll arrive at a different hash value, a different random key, and then when you attempt the decryption, the result will be gibberish, and with a very high probability, the canary won't be the value that you're expecting. So assuming the canary is the value that we were expecting, it's stripped, and then we return the data to the next, the higher level, which is typically the user or application. So our architecture provides a variety of methods for dispersing information. In the simplest, an application can integrate directly with our, we have a Java library to communicate slices directly to the storage servers. Alternatively, the client can post a blob through an HTTP post to an accessor appliance. And this offloads the slicing and dispersal to the accessor machine. The accessor appliance can also provide an iSCSI target for receiving blocks to be written or read. And these blocks may be received directly from the client if it's running an iSCSI initiator, or they may come from an intermediate NAS head, which is depicted by this gateway, which exposes NFS or SIFS interfaces. So here's a picture of the CleverSafe data center, and in it you can actually see the machines on which our production results were performed. The test involved eight production storage servers and one client, which was using the Java library to write 10 megabyte objects for 10 minutes and then read them back for another 10 minutes. And then we looked at how much data was actually transferred from the client's perspective. To rule out the possibility that the disks were a bottleneck, we ran all the tests again, this time with two clients performing the same operations against the same storage servers to see if there's any difference in performance. And the performance, whether we ran one client or two clients, the performance for each client was essentially identical in both cases. So the bottleneck didn't appear to be in the storage layer. And also considering the network bandwidth available, there was the first bottleneck would be the 1 gigabyte per second, which consisted of the 8 1 gigabit per second NICs of each of the storage servers. And all of the results were well below that limit. So the bottleneck appeared to be within the CPU. When we looked at the utilization using TOP, it was running at about 90%. So this chart details the performance results which we measured. Note that the yellow bars are from the live production results, while the pink bars are from our performance model. In all cases, our performance model was within 10% of our observations. So the control consisted of running, you can think of an 8 of 8 dispersal. Essentially, that's performing only the slicing of data and no matrix multiplication at all, but it's still running through our entire stack. So it's being serialized, processed, sliced, put through our protocol message, and written to over the network to slice stores, which then write them to disks. In the AONT and Rabin implementations, we used a 5 of 8 configuration. And you may notice that there are two implementations of AONT RS. We chose to look at two implementations because, as I mentioned, the choice of the cipher and hash function is flexible. So in AONT FAST, we use a cipher and hash function optimized for performance. We use RC4 for encrypting and MD5 for hashing. While in the security optimized version, we use AES-256 with SHA-256. So note that while AONT RS provides a much higher degree of security than Rabin, it has comparable performance. And our performance model suggests that there are many cases where the performance of AONT RS will actually exceed that of Rabin, in particular for the kinds of deployments our customers are most likely to use. So our customers will normally use configurations where the K to N ratio is close to 1. So each of these graphs you see has a different K over N ratio. So the first one is 1 to 6, the next is 1 to 3, and so on. The latter two graphs, if have K of N ratios of 2 and 3 and 5 and 5 to 6. So those will have overheads of 1.5 and 1.2. Whereas if you look at the previous, you're looking at 2, 3, or 6 times replication, essentially. So those earlier ones aren't as efficient. And typically, customers will have an N between 10 and 30. So I've highlighted those results, and you can see for those ranges, the performance-optimized AONT outperforms essentially all the others. And for wider configurations, even the security-optimized version of AONT also outperforms Rubin. So here's a real-life example of one of our deployments. It's for the Museum of Broadcast Communications. And it's a 10 of 16 configuration across 8 sites. The way we chose the sites was also such that it's across 3 power grids, such that any of the 3 major power grids in the United States could go offline, yet there would still be a threshold number of machines online and available. So in conclusion, we've shown how dispersal offers a variety of benefits for storage, reliability, efficiency, scalability, and performance. And it also provides security without the need for a separate key management system. We presented a new dispersal algorithm that has an attractive blend of both performance and security and evaluated its performance both theoretically and experimentally. And lastly, we've described a system in use which relies on this algorithm. Thank you.
Hi, Mark Littlebridge, HP Labs. Why wouldn't it be better to just take your data, encrypt it, take the encryption key, distribute it with secret sharing, and then use erasure coding to distribute the fragments? That way I don't have to watch the fragments. I can put them on a commercial storage. It doesn't matter. I just have to watch my key fragments, which are much, much, much smaller.
So in the system you're describing, are you imagining there's a single key for all the data, or?
Well, for each piece of data in the same way you have, you basically have a separate random key for it, right?
Mm-hmm. So there are a few reasons why we chose this approach. One is, even if you're doing these Shamir shares to multiple locations, if you want the encrypted data to be readily accessible to users wherever they are, they have to be able to connect and communicate to these nodes, recover the shares to get their key, and then use that to decrypt the data. So in both contexts, you have N machines which are online and exposed to network requests, and
Well, no, you'd have more machines in the case where, in your case, because if you have more data, you need more machines to hold it, whereas I can have a smaller number of machines with the keys, even if they're at the same site, right?
I see. Yeah, so in both cases, you have to focus on the security of the nodes, not just the nodes storing the shares, but also the ones storing the data, because even in your example, if the nodes storing the data aren't secure, someone can get on and either corrupt them or delete the files, and again, you'll lose availability. The advantage of your proposal is you don't have to worry about the confidentiality as much, but again, in both cases, you have to have both secure nodes for data storage and for the key storage. Thank you.
Hi, Bill Belosky from Microsoft Research. First, okay. I got to say CleverSafe is a great name because this is really clever.
Thank you.
So I don't understand why you need to use a secure hash in AONT. If the idea of it is that in order to decrypt it, you've got to have all of the input data, if I use CRC 128 there, I'm no more going to be able to guess what the CRC value is out of something, out of data that I don't have, than I could guess the MD5 value or the SHA-256 value. So if your bottleneck is performance, hashes are moderately, crypto hashes are moderately expensive relative to CRC. So
right. So I would say the reason why a secure hash algorithm would be required is because we're also using it to guarantee integrity. If we were to use a CRC, if someone were to get a hold of the last slice, let's say a hacker breaks into the machine, which source of the last slice, and that slice contains the difference value. It would be possible for an attacker to flip a bit in the slice and also be able to predict what effect that will have on the calculation of the CRC, even if they don't know the rest of the data, because CRC is linear.
Cipher, right? If you're running if you're running a stream cipher, that's certainly true.
Yeah.
But they have to predict the difference in the output of the decrypted, right? I mean, the canary is after the decryption. So mm-hmm. It seems to me that if you're running like an ECB thing, there's
yeah. If you're using AES, you would probably be protected with a CRC, but our implementation, as I mentioned, does support RC4 with MD5, in which case a CRC would be subject to, because both CRC and RC4 are linear.
Yes. Yep. But you might think about doing the AES with CRC. It's worth thinking about anyway.
Yeah, that's a good suggestion. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Asar Westland from Pyramid. First, I'd like to say that I think this, as everybody else said before, is clever and interesting. I think your presentation could benefit from more saying what the threat model is that you're looking at. Mm-hmm. And in particular, if I were to store data in this way at my service provider, or at my server providers, if they got together, they could figure out what my data was. Mm-hmm. And encryption, which is kind of what you're comparing against, the way we normally use it, as long as it's not a one-time pad, has the benefit that I can have something much smaller, hence the word key, to unlock my data, and even the people that store my data can't get to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's an excellent point. So the threat model that we considered, and we describe it in our paper, is essentially that of, so this is mainly for enterprise storage, where there's an organization that wants to maintain control of their data. And you don't want administrators to be able to walk off with drives or nodes and be able to recover useful information. So in an organization, you also don't want employees to leave with an encryption key or a password and hold your data hostage. So in that particular use case, it may even be an advantage to organizations because ultimately they control the nodes and they can always get the data back and not worry about keys being taken from them. But in the context of a personal storage where you're using like a cloud storage provider, I see your point where you may want to maintain complete control of your encryption key.
Thank you.
Thanks for that answer. Let's thank all the speakers again.